So I just remind you that on Tuesday, the second session I did this week was called Problems and Promise of Microcredit. And it was really designed to in 1 hour, teach as much as I could about microfinance, microcredit, how the cycle works. You've sent around this handout. You can kind of share them. This is an Oikocredit diagram about how Oikocredit works, but it's a good diagram to use for understanding microfinance in general. And particularly for those who are listening to this as a podcast, you might want to look for the second session first, and then you'll be, I presume some knowledge of that session and this session, but you can always ask me questions if I start talking in technical terms that you can't relate to. The diagram should help you follow from the investor to Oikocredit, to the microfinance institutions, to the small businesses, the ultimate borrowers, back to the microfinance institution, which repays Oikocredit, which then pays a dividend to the investor. So in this USA Today op-ed piece published in May, Olivia Teeter, vice president at the spirituality-based RSF Social Finance, says, you can transform the world if you can change the way people work with money, with their money. And in the book, Money and Faith, that I've been promoting all week long because it has such great study guides, Andy Loving, who is a Baptist, ordained Baptist minister, who also works as a financial advisor, Andy says in here, in the chapter entitled Investing, the Poor, and Social Change, he believes that how we use money is one of the best indicators of how we understand the Christian faith journey. Those are broad sweeping claims. I'm not here to defend them, but just as an opener to kind of make the case that why what we're doing tonight is important. The norm in how we handle money in this country is maximization of profit, right? And all you're concerned about, if you're trying to maximize profit, is how much money went in, what are the risk factors I'm facing, and how much is my money going to grow, right? That's all we as American capitalists have been trained to think about. But for the last 35 years, led by churches and other faith communities, the Jewish community is very strongly involved, there has been a growing SRI movement of socially responsible investing. It's concerned about a couple of different issues. It says it matters what your capital is doing. When you put money into an investment, it matters what happens to the money as far as the environmental concerns. You know, what is the corporation you've invested in doing with your money in terms of its impact on the environment? Look at the Bhopal disaster in India. How would you feel about being invested in, was that Dow Chemical? How'd you feel about being invested in Dow Chemical?
Union Carbide,
thank you, that's right. If you knew more about what happens to the environment around around your money, around the companies that your money's invested in. So the SRI movement, socially responsible investing, says it matters what happens, what your capital does environmentally. It matters what your capital does to its workers. Nike got in a lot of trouble a few years ago for when stories came out about the use of children as workers in Vietnam. And it matters to what it does to consumers. The way in which pharmaceuticals have influenced the thinking about medicine in this country based on their interest in selling drugs. Or, you know, my daughter, who is just born beautiful, thinks she's not unless she's got a lot of makeup on. Oh, she's not in here. I mean, that's purely the result of advertising by the cosmetic industry. Right? So, SRI, the Socially Responsible Investment Movement, says it matters what the capital is doing, number one, and number two, who benefits. Now, this, you know, some people scratch their head and say, what do you mean who benefits? Obviously, the only possible benefit is to the investor. We're so programmed to believe that the only thing that can happen from our investment is growing our money. But of course, what that means is those who have money to invest get richer. And the whole way the rich get richer under capitalism is that they have money to invest, they grow it, and it comes back to them. But for the last 35 years, and gaining some momentum now, as evidenced by the USA Today op-ed piece, Christians are beginning to say, no, we can invest not just to grow our money, but also to have a social impact. Instead of those who have more, those who have get more, now there's a movement to say those who have can invest their money in a way that empowers the poor. You can put your money in one of the big banks, and we know what the profits from that go to the investors in the big bank. Or there's a growing movement to put your money into local community banks that invest in those communities, that make loans to people that are excluded from the lending process by the big commercial banks. There are three legs to the SRI movement. And in order of popularity, the most, I'm going to list the most popular first and the least effective first. So the most popular is the least effective, in my opinion. And that's screened investing. So for a long time, churches have been, Southern Baptists screen out companies that profit from the sale of alcohol. Some hospitals have decided to screen out of their investment portfolio companies that produce and sell tobacco. Those are screens. You can say to your investment advisor, I don't want, you can, I want to align my values with my portfolio so that I feel better about the companies I'm invested in. So screened investing is the most popular form of SRI and, in my opinion, the least impactful. The second most popular and middle of the three in terms of impact is shareholder activism. The shareholder activism movement in this country is about 35 years old. It's coordinated by the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility in New York City, ICCR.org. And it operates on the principle that you leverage your ownership to influence the behavior and policy of corporations by working in coalition with those who vote their proxy at the annual meeting. So there are every company, I mean, there are some different rules according to the Securities and Exchange Commission about how you can, how long you can keep an issue on the ballot at the annual meeting. But basically, ICCR and its regional affiliates, there's one in Seattle called the Northwest Coalition for Responsible Investment, what they do is bring together investors, especially those who represent a whole group of investments, and file a shareholder resolution to get ExxonMobil to establish its carbon footprint. They did this with Chevron. Chevron resisted year after year. Every year the boat kept getting a little bit larger, and finally Chevron's management said, we better look into this. And so Chevron agreed to establish their, to just document their carbon footprint. Now once you know your carbon footprint, you can watch Chevron from year to year and see, is it getting less or is it getting more? There's a, if I was doing a session on this, I would cite all kinds of changes in corporate policy. Marriott Hotels now has a policy to train its employees against sexual trafficking of minors. Same thing for Continental Airlines. As a result of the shareholder activism movement, Continental trains its flight attendants to spot situations of sexual trafficking. The third leg of socially responsible investing is the one we're going to be talking about tonight. It's the least used, and I believe the most potentially potent, and that's community investing. Basically, putting capital into the hands of those who have not had it for the purpose of empowering them, not making the rich richer, but the rich saying, I want some of my wealth to benefit and empower the poor. And we're going to look at shares the same origins as the organization I'll introduce, which is Oiko Credit. I'll talk about the name in a minute. In 1968, at the World Council of Churches Assembly in Uppsala, Sweden, and a few months before he was assassinated, Martin Luther King spoke. Now, you know, it's 1968, there's protests going on all over the place. The World Council of Churches is passing resolutions against apartheid in South Africa and against the war in Vietnam. And King stands up and says, "Good for you, but isn't it a little bit hypocritical to pass these resolutions when your pension funds and your church investment funds are profiting from the war in Vietnam or from apartheid in South Africa?" And he so embarrassed the World Council of Churches that they set up a study commission to look at the issue. And 7 years later, it was decided that the World Council should set up a, or spin off, really, established, not as a department of the World Council, because it was too complicated of an institution, but establish a development bank for the poor. Establish a bank that would make credit available to the poor, because the studies that they had looked at said that one of the biggest problems is the poor have no access to credit. And how do we in the West learn to establish ourselves and become financially stable? And how do we get housing? And it's all through investing in a capitalist order. So they decided to establish a bank that would make loans to poor people's cooperatives. And they intentionally targeted co-ops because they felt they struggled the most to get access to credit. That capitalist institutions didn't like cooperatives, and poor people's co-ops in the global south and denied capitalists. So Oiko Credit is established under the name the original one, the Ecumenical Cooperative Development Society, EDCS, Ecumenical Development Cooperative Society. That was a mouthful. And so some of us were glad when they chose Oiko Credit as a name. Oiko Credit comes from two words. The Greek word oikos, who knows what it means besides West, I'm sure. Household, welfare of the household. And it gives us three really common words in English. Ecology, economics, and ecumen. Those three words come from the Greek word oikos, welfare of the household. And then credit comes from cradle. Churches. By 1975, Oiko Credit is incorporated as a global cooperative of churches in the Netherlands under Dutch law as a nonprofit. They got the nonprofit recognition by promising not to pay more than 2% financial burden. The original intention is to make these large loans to poor people's cooperatives, 1975. Now, who remembers from the session on Tuesday what happened in 1976? Somebody, yeah. Who said that? There you go.
The Grameen Bank was established.
Yep, Muhammad Yunus discovers microfinance as a principle, microcredit, and establishes the Grameen Bank. The year after, Oiko Credit is established to make loans to cooperatives. Today, Oiko Credit, about 80% of its loan portfolio goes to microcredit, and 20% still goes to the co-ops and small and medium-sized enterprises in the global south. Today, there are 43,000 investors, worldwide, almost $700 million in capital outstanding. It's 461 million euros as of March 31st. I'm guessing it's about $700 million. 875 project partners in 71 countries. These are big numbers in the world of international development. With, as I said, 85% of the loan capital going to microfinance lending, and microfinance lending to 600 partners. Now, in the world of microfinance, that's huge, and it's risky. If you, I heard once that the second most prolific lender in the microfinance world might work with 150 MFIs, microfinance institutions. Microcredit's working with 600. So a much wider variety. I know a microfinance organization in Seattle that works with a couple of dozen MFIs in Central America. You know, just target that. That's a way to control the risk. Oikocredit is taking a lot of risk and managing it very well, as I'll say more about a little bit further down the line here. Just to put some easier to understand face on it. This is the once a quarter, Oikocredit publishes its facts and figures. This is from the first quarter report of 2011. And there's about 20 copies or some copies here. Underneath it is more copies that I had left over from a previous quarter report last year. Under recent deal, and you can cite one. This is not to a microfinance institution. This is still goes to other kinds of loans. It's a 580,000 euro loan. It's big money. That's what would it be, $750 million, something like that? $750,000. To the Don Bosco Foundation for Sustainable Development in the Philippines. This organization is focused on implementing and promoting sustainable development by supporting small farmers in Cotabato, the southern island of Mindanao, in the Philippines, the poorest part of the Philippines. With this loan, the organization will assist 130 rice farmers and their families to redeem 200 hectares of land mortgaged under unfair mortgage practices. Sound familiar? The foundation will then assist in converting these farms from conventional rice production to production of biodynamic organic rice. Without this assistance, many farmers would be at risk of losing their land and their livelihood. That's one of the deals done during the first quarter of this year. All right, key features of Oikocredit. What distinguishes it? First, that it's a cooperative. It might be the only internationally operating cooperative society in the world. Think about co-ops, cooperatives that you know. Let's name some.
PCC.
PCC in Seattle, Puget Consumers Co-op. Food, very successful grocery store chain, basically. But in the Seattle area, maybe seven branches. Doesn't exist outside of Washington State. REI does exist outside of Washington State, but I don't think it's international. Am I right? Does anybody know? Might be, but I don't think it is.
We have an equivalent in Canada, NEC, same thing.
Same thing, but doesn't cross the national boundaries.
Correct.
And so Oikocredit thinks it might be the only internationally operating co-op. Organic Valley is a co-op, if you know that label. Owned by the farmers, it's producing farmers. The cooperative structure has interesting governance implications. The largest institutional investor for Oikocredit globally is the Church of Sweden. 15 million euros was the level they were at a few years ago. It's probably grown since then. The minimum to be a member of the co-op as a church organization is 250 euros. And there are a number of African churches that are members of the co-op at 250 euros. At the annual general meeting of Oikocredit, you get one vote, whether you've got 15 million euros invested or 250 euros invested. Now that turns our ideas about capitalism on their head, because you get on the board of General Motors by being a major investor, right? The Oikocredit Global Board has more members coming from the borrowing countries than it does from the investing countries. Need drives policy, not investment. Because the point isn't to maximize your financial profit. The point of the investors is to maximize the social dividend and receive a modest financial return. Right now it looks pretty good at 2%, but that wasn't the case prior to 2008. Although I know a lot of people that wish, including myself, that we had all of our investments in Oikocredit, because nobody has ever lost a penny of their capital invested in Oikocredit. And of the 35 years, it's paid the 2% dividend, which is not guaranteed, 34 of the 35 years. But about every year, the board votes what dividend to pay. And it has almost always maintained the 2% dividend. One year, they paid 1%. Million borrowers are directly reached by the partners of Oikocredit. 86% of them are female. 44% are in rural areas. That is huge, because the rural areas are the toughest place to work. And so I talked on Tuesday about how there were 30 funds in 2004, 30 microfinance funds. And by 2009, it was 100 funds, because the thing was growing so rapidly. Those are funds that have come into being in the last 10 years. Oikocredit's been there 35 years. Most of those funds target a specific area, and most of them, particularly if they're trying to maximize their financial return, are working only in the cities where it's safer and cheaper, more cost effective to do lending than it is in the rural areas. Let me check and see. I haven't invited you to make questions. I will along the way. Please raise your hand along the way, and if I don't see you upstairs, give me a verbal cue.
Do you have any power as to where, what country your investment might go towards?
As an investor, no. And this is one of the big differences with Kiva, for example. In the case of Kiva, the whole thing is, I said on Tuesday, donor-centric. It's catering to the interests of the donors, which is why it's been so spectacularly successful at getting donor investment. It's not an investment, money. It's an unsecured loan. They don't promise to pay your loan back, but they are usually able to pay that loan back if you want it. People kind of treat it as a donation. In the case of Oikocredit, there's professional staff that work on where the money goes, and you have no say whatsoever as an investor about where your money goes. So the two sides to the Oikocredit house, those raising the investment capital and sending it to the other side of the house, which specializes in how to distribute it. I'll get to you in a second.
Okay.
One of the key features that distinguishes Oikocredit is its network of offices in the Global South, in about 30 countries of the Global South, staffed by local people. The microfinance organization I referenced in Seattle is based in Seattle, staffed largely by Americans, and then they work with some on-the-ground consultants in Central America, but a lot of travel back and forth and a lot less access by the borrowers to the expertise of the organization. So one of the reasons that MFIs want to work with Oikocredit is the locally staffed offices that are with people from the regions that they're serving. Now, you have a question.
I think I heard you say that 86% of the loans sponsored by Oikocredit go to females.
86%.
Why is that so?
Oikocredit's loans, if you look at this diagram here, don't go to the ultimate borrower. They go to a middle agency called an MFI.
Okay.
And then 86% of the clients of those MFIs are women. Why? Because the whole phenomenon of microfinance has discovered that women make better partners for those seeking social social return. Women spend their money that they are. Women take. First of all, women are have less access to credit than men do in the world, even in the United States, for that matter, but especially outside the United States. Secondly, when women get a microloan and use it successfully, the money they earn goes into their household and their family. Men tend to spend the money on status symbols, or at the local bar, or in parties. So the overwhelming percentage of microfinance borrowers tend to be women. And it's just I cite it as a evidence that Oiko Credit is fulfilling a social purpose, because it's well known globally that women are more disadvantaged than men. So if you're trying to achieve a social purpose in the lending business, you achieve more social purpose by getting your loans in the hands of women than you do men. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So would a man with a good idea have a tougher time getting a microcredit loan than a woman?
You know, I don't know, and I think it would depend on the MFI and its policies. The one MFI that I've actually visited and talked with, I've met men and women borrowers. But that MFI would take men farmers who have already got some land and got a scale of economy going, and make a loan to them at maybe the $2,000 level to expand their agricultural production.
Okay.
The women that they target as first-time borrowers with $50 loans will be women's groups. They'll go out and really try to put together a giving circle of 10 women and give them a $500 loan and help them get started. And some of those women will graduate to the $1,000 or $2,000 level. That men might come in at earlier because they're already in the economic stream. Make sense? Other questions? Yeah.
It's probably a silly question, but why couldn't we invest in a local MFI and bypass FICO?
How would you do it?
I'm not sure I'm certain.
No.
If I know something in a particular country that's an MFI,
well, churches do it all the time. I mean, someone was in here on Tuesday who talked about their parish. Their parish has set up a micro loan fund. Was it you? Okay, with another. You can do it. The advantage of doing it through Oiko Credit, I think, is that I've met some of those staff in those countries, and they blow me away with their sophistication. These are highly trained, often outside of their countries in the global north, highly skilled professionals whose job it is to really go in and financially vet the capability of this institution to handle what size loan and growth. Oiko Credit will work with new MFIs and help develop them up to the level where they can, you know, after maybe one or two or three loan cycles, where they can go out and get commercial credit. But it targets MFIs that can't get commercial credit right now, provides the technical assistance after the business review and the troubleshooting. I was told how the local loan officer works up the proposal and then sends it to the Netherlands and a committee for approval. Once the loan is approved, documents are signed at the local level, money is dispersed to the local directly from the Netherlands, money is sent to the partner, and then the loan payments go directly to the Netherlands. You don't want them going through the hands of a local collector, because God knows what would happen. The minute a loan payment is late, the alarm bells go off, and a message is sent to the local office where, you know, partner X is late on a payment, and the local office sends a staff person out there to say, you know, is there a problem? What's going on? How can we help you? And if necessary, reschedule the loan, but provide a lot more local technical and business support that I think can be done from here to there. For one thing, what do we know about the local conditions?
A little bit.
But we're not from that area. Yeah.
What is the interest rate that borrowers pay for OICO credit?
OICO credit used to charge 9%, flat 9%, from OICO credit to the MFI. And then, of course, the MFI is going to charge a larger percentage rate to the ultimate borrower. Today, OICO credit has a variable interest rate, and I'll talk about what are the factors that govern that. But it always tries to ensure, it always tries to verify what's the rate that the ultimate borrower is going to pay. And it has a cap on how much it will allow the ultimate borrower to pay, and if it's above that rate, it will not make the loan. I think the highest rate an OICO credit loan can allow the ultimate borrower to pay is in the neighborhood of 24%. Sounds high, but as I said on Tuesday, Washington State, only after great battles, passed a law last year. And this law came up year after year, and it was voted down, thanks to lobbying by the payday loan shop industry. Only last year did Washington State cap the maximum interest rate that can be charged on payday loans in Washington State at 39%. Which is why payday loan shops, after sprouting up everywhere, are now starting to close. I just saw one downtown Seattle closed the other day.
It still sounds high.
It still sounds high. And that's a reflection of our privilege. And we have no idea how privileged we are for access to capital. The poor are subject to the loan sharks, who charge literally interest rates in the thousands of percent. You know, you take $50 from me today, you owe me $100 tomorrow. And I'll break your knees if you don't pay. The poor of the world are paying a lot. Now, the 24% is high. It's the maximum. The MFI that I talked to, it's very complicated, but I found it fascinating. The initial interest rate that they'll charge to the giving circle of 50 10 $50 loans to 10 women, a $500 loan to the giving circle divided 10 ways. Comes back at, I think he said, 14% interest, of which two or 3% go into a savings account for the women. They can't spend it for a while, but some of that interest rate is developing savings for them and their group. Some of it is paying the bills of the MFI. And then the 9% that comes back to OICO credit, average 9%. It used to be a flat 9%, and I am in a minute going to tell you what are the factors by which they decide how much the interest rate is right now. And the latest numbers I saw on the latest round of loans ranged from about 8% to about 13% variable, according to these factors I'll list in a second. That money, 2%, goes to the investor. A certain percentage goes into the risk fund because not every loan works, and you're trying to protect the capital of your investors. Remember, nobody's lost a penny yet as an investor, although I am obligated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, having said that, to tell you that future performance of these investments is past performance is no guarantee of future performance. That's the law. And some of the money goes to pay the overhead of OICO credit. But as long as we're on the subject of the overhead of OICO credit, one of the reasons it can make the loans at less than the cost of those loans to OICO credit is because of the army of volunteers. You cannot meet any of the OICO credit employees in the Netherlands and not hear from them their profound respect for the networks of volunteers organized in 36 support associations in 16 countries who do most of the marketing and fundraising work for OICO credit. So on this Q&A, questions and answers sheet I've got from Waco Credit. How come you have never heard of Waco Credit? Because it hasn't spent money on introducing itself. Until 2 years ago, Waco Credit USA had one staff person for the whole country, one employee. Now, it's only raising 6% of its capital in the United States. That's another reason why we haven't heard about it. But even in Europe, the number of employees focused on raising the capital is way low compared to every other microfinance organization I know. And even those loans that they're making out are at less than cost. So they depend on some other sources to raise that. It's really, there's a reason why half of the adults in the world do not use formal financial services. And that's stunning to me. I had a bank account when I was 13 years old. And I use a cash machine every week. I can't imagine living without banking service. Half of the world's adults don't have access, don't use formal financial services. And in the global south, in the really poor countries, it jumps to like 70% of people don't even have access. It's not a personal choice, because the banks don't exist, because they can't operate profitably in those areas. So it does sound high, I grant you, and it is high, but it is not an example of ripping off those people. It's an example of how privileged we are in our society. I really believe that. And it's why loan sharks exist everywhere. And if it was too high, if it was unfairly high, there wouldn't be the demand. There is today more demand for Oracle Credit money than there is investment to deploy, which is why Oracle Credit is starting to professionalize and work better on supporting volunteers like me to raise the money. The 36th and newest support association for Oracle Credit is Oracle Credit Northwest, based in Seattle. And we're brand new.
What does that do?
What does the support association do? We're a member of the cooperative, and we have our mission is twofold: to promote microcredit as an effective strategy for addressing global poverty, and Oiko Credit as the best microcredit organization. And it's largely churches. There are a few non-church people.
It's all volunteer.
It was all volunteer until 11 months ago, when we hired our first staff person, a part-time, 10, 15-hour-a-week investment advisor who was working on socially responsible stuff. And we raised some charitable money and hired her. We get a Oiko Credit, it's in their interest to help volunteers raise the capital, because then they take the capital, lend it out at an average of 9%, and that comes back to them. The 9% mostly comes back, 90% of their loans, 10% of the dispersed loans have been written off. That's a really good rate in that business. But 10% of the money you lend out doesn't come back to you, you gotta replace it somehow. So there's a very complex formula that calculates how much money has a support association raised from how many different investors, and then you qualify for an annual fee from Waco Credit to help you pay your costs. The scene in Europe is totally different on investing. There's been so much stock market fraud in the United States that there are huge regulatory hurdles to get over. And Waco Credit globally is very frustrated at how much money it's spent trying to get going in the richest country in the world, and how little they have to show for it. But our support association in Seattle last year raised $180,000 of investments. New investment money.
Are those mostly individuals or churches or both?
Mostly individuals. The largest institutional investors in the United States tend to be hospital systems. Sisters of Providence Hospital System in Seattle has a pair of $1.8 million investments. $1.9 million, $3.8 million total.
And what is the minimum investment?
The minimum for our retail investor is $250.
In Seattle?
Yeah, well, not in Seattle right now. I'll get to that in a minute. But in the United States, the minimum investment, it used to be $1,000, and just a year and a half ago, it was lowered to $250. There's a tension, you know. It costs as much to process a $250 investment and to take care of it as it does a $100,000 investment. So, you know, there's a cost benefit for the organization, how much overhead we're going to do, but, and it's been a running battle. I'm on the U.S. board, I should have disclosed that. But as a volunteer, I don't get any payment out of it. Other than the interest rate on the $25,000 that my wife and I have invested. I have been an investor personally for 23 years. I tried to work that one job in the United States. I applied for it in 1984, didn't get it. Applied for it again in 1987, came in second, which does me no good. And in 1987, when I didn't get the job, I said, you know, I think this is a great organization. I'm going to invest in it. I was, I don't know, 30 years old. But I scraped together the $1,000 and bought an investment, and it is the best investment I've ever made, and I've been growing it ever since. And a couple of years ago, when I realized that my money market for my liquid cash for an emergency for my family was drawing under 0.5%, I moved it all into Oiko Credit, so we've got $25,000 there now, and we get a 2% interest. That's my only material interest in that. One more question, then I'm going to go back to my notes. Jeff?
2 weeks ago, I heard the Oiko Credit pitch at St. Mark's, and then found it quite a downer, you know, when I was all revved up.
About what's happening in Washington State?
Pardon?
About what's happening in Washington State?
Yes.
Yeah, let me get to that. That's in my notes. Okay? It'll just take me off track if we go there right now, but we will get there in a second. So I talked about the huge volunteer involvement from people in 16 countries. Germany is the strongest right now. It's just on fire in terms of the amount of money coming through German churches. Locally staffed regional offices. Oh, interest rate. I promised somebody the information about how the interest rate is calculated. It varies by five factors. Number one, what's the market rate in that country? An Oiko Credit. Now keep in mind that Oiko Credit is lending to people who can't qualify for the market rate, who can't get a loan from the market, the unbankable. And its interest rates tend to be about 95% of what the market rate in that country is. So when they decide what the interest rate they're going to charge an MFI in that organization, in that country, they look at the market rate there and come in at about 95% of it. They look at the risk of the project. Some projects are riskier than others. The greater the risk, the higher the interest rate. They look at the development potential. Is this some new innovation that has huge potential, if it works, for improving economic development in that area? If it is, then they get a lower interest rate if it's got some potential that's worth taking a chance on. They look at environmental factors on whether or not to make the loan, but that doesn't affect the interest. They look at the cost of executing that loan. It's much more costly out in some remote village than it is in the capital city. You just got to travel back and forth, and you're paying somebody to make those trips. And they look at the country risk. Some countries are riskier to work in than others. They don't not work there. Nigeria is one of the most notoriously difficult places to work right now. And at the last annual general meeting, at a board meeting last winter, the global board decided to make Nigeria a priority. They were not working there. They're going to go in and they're going to try and work there. They will be, and a lot of other microfinance organizations are watching to see whether it can work. Oiko Credit takes risks and initiative in places that others won't. It has about 14% of its microfinance loan portfolio operative in Africa right now, and that is way high compared to most organizations that work globally. A lot of them won't touch Africa because it's so much more difficult to work in than Asia or Latin America, for example.
Why?
It's more rural. The infrastructure for business and education is lower. Their need is greater. But if you've traveled in Latin America and Africa, you just, you see right away, where is the infrastructure stronger? Risk factors. They work in hard to work places geographically in terms of the country or continent, and also rural versus urban. They make loans for 5 to 10 years. That's unheard of in the microfinance industry. You lower your risk by lending somebody the money for 6 months or 1 year or a year and a half. So to get the capital for 5 to 10 years is to increase your risk, but it's also extremely valuable for poor and newly emerging borrowers.
Are they repaying those 5 to 10 year loans on an installment plan?
Yeah. And the installment plan has favorable terms, and it usually involves a grace period. Unlike some that will say, okay, your money is dispersed today and your first payment is due a month from now, Local Credit will disperse the money, give you a 3-month grace period to begin as an MFI to turn around. Because as an MFI, you've got to take that money, lend it out to somebody else, start getting payments from them before you start repaying the original loan to Echo Credit. So the grace period is a big factor. You know, I'm trying to do too much data here. I should give you a narrative. I said in the marketing pitch up on the kiosk there that microcredit is really hot among generally younger people in the Pacific Northwest who think churches are irrelevant to stuff that really matters, like addressing global poverty. And in evidence of that opinion, there's an organization in Seattle called SEMO, SEAMO.org, Seattle Microfinance Organization. It's a networking thing. It's all volunteer, and they organize, they stage these microbrew events. Downtown Seattle. 100, 120 people. I went to one of them. Nobody in the room was more than half my age. I walk in, I pay my $5, you know, I get a drink. And before I knew it, I was talking to the founder of SEMO, who's a congregationalist. But, you know, that room was not filled with church people. He happened to be. And he said, what brings you here? I mean, I stuck out being so old. What brings you here? I said, well, I've been an investor and interested in Oiko Credit for a long time. He said, Oiko Credit? I've never met anybody in the United States who's ever heard of it, but every MFI I've ever visited in the Global South always says it's their preferred source if they can get such a loan. I mean, made my day that he would say that. And that room that night had 120 young people who came out to listen to somebody from the Gates Foundation talk about emerging trends in microcredit. These were people working in the banking sector or people who would love to work in microcredit, believe in it as a strategy, and who I would love to know, I would love for them to discover that the world's best microcredit organization is a global cooperative of churches. But before we can... We can use that as an evangelical tool. Churches are going to have to learn about our best ever ecumenical experiment. 45% of the loans are made in local currency. That's, nobody else does that. You know, they take my 25 grand, that's in US dollars. I want it back in US dollars. I don't care that they lend it to somebody in some country where the currency goes through the floor. And what happens when the currency goes through the floor and they've made they've borrowed in hard currency? They it's almost impossible for them to pay that back. So, and that's one of the reasons why that 10% loan loss has occurred. When Oiko Credit saw that trend developing, they said, we're just gonna have to figure out how to make loans in local currency. And almost half of their lending in microcredit now is made to MFIs in local currency, which is hugely valuable to MFIs just getting started. Low or no collateral. Low collateral, or in some cases, no collateral. That's huge. Serves a wide range of MFIs and project partners. And the other stuff I've covered, except for the social performance. And then the issue you were pointing to, Jack, which which doesn't apply to everybody in the room, but we are going to address it. WICO Credit is the first microfinance organization to actually set up a department dedicated to social performance. I mean, there are some other microfinance organizations that are social dividend motivated, but for the most part, in the microcredit world, people they invest in the business expertise of evaluating the loans and dispersing them, and the accountants to keep track of them. Because you can sell, as I said on Tuesday, you can sell microcredit on the anecdote. Mrs. Gonzalez was very poor. She got a $100 loan. Look at her today. So if you'll give us more money, we will create more Mrs. Gonzalez. WICO Credit's the first microfinance organization that said, we have to start measuring social performance. And so they got involved with the Progress Out of Poverty Index created by the Grameen Foundation, which is a little tool that 10 questionnaire that can be very quickly filled out by the loan officer as he walks up the door to the house where he's collecting the money. What's the roofing material like, if that's a factor for determining relative poverty in one country? And so the roofing materials in one country are different than another country, so the PPI tool is different in one country. It's a country-specific tool that has 10 questions designed to help identify the level of economic benefit, the economic level at which the borrower is living. And the idea is if you invest in collecting data 1 year, the second year, the third year, by the fifth year, you ought to be able to see whether you're making a difference or what kind of difference you're making in the lives of people. And OICO Credit is investing some of that interest rate that it collects in developing tools to do social performance measurement. They're also the first microfinance organization in the world to use the tool, the social audit tool of Cerisa. Cerisa is a French learning network. And they developed, we're all familiar with financial audits, or more or less, you've heard of them at least. You know, a nonprofit or your church maybe has somebody come in and audit your books, to see what a financial audit. Have you ever heard of someone auditing the mission of your church or nonprofit organization? And a group of French academics developed a tool that's designed to help a nonprofit organization audit its mission. WICO Credit went through the audit, and having done it itself, is now pushing that out to its regional offices and encouraging more and more of its MFIs to actually audit their social mission and see whether they're doing what they claim to do. Now, one last thing, as an example of the social performance stuff. CGAP is an organization housed at the World Bank. It's housed at the World Bank. It's not of the World Bank. It's called Consultative Group to Assist the Poor, CGAP. And they decided, as they looked at the conditions of poor around the world and all the development aid trying to improve them, that they really wanted to improve ESG, which is a term you're going to begin to hear more about. Environmental, social, and governance factors. So if you want to promote more attention to those three things, you create the ESG award. So CGAP, big global anti-poverty group analyzing the work of international development organizations, creates the ESG award and offers it for the first time just about exactly a year ago. Three organizations were recipients, including WICO Credit. Now I've talked to I set up an opportunity for a French woman who's married to somebody at the Gates Foundation and lives in Seattle. It was a wonderful thing. We're setting up a panel because we're bringing somebody from the Netherlands to speak about microfinance in Seattle, and I knew nobody would come out to do an OICO Credit presentation, so we set up a panel at Seattle U, and we had various people, well-known and less-known in the Seattle area, to the microcredit interested people. And then we put Ilse van der Stoep from the Netherlands in that panel. Well, one of the panel members is, I forget her name, this French woman, who is a consultant to SIGAP, and who turns out to have been the SIGAP consultant that did all the work on the ESG award. It was so wonderful. Somebody starts off talking about the importance of social performance measurement. Somebody else applies it to an environmental organization. Then comes the French woman who talks about the SIGAP's ESG award and how they went about evaluating all these organizations. And she said, at the end of the day, we gave the award to three, but it was really clear that Oikocredit was way in front of the other two. We just didn't want to create competition among the winners, so we gave it to all three, but Oikocredit was way ahead of the other two. And then the Oikocredit lady speaks. It was a perfect setup. You couldn't have paid it. It could have happened better than that. Now, this thing about Washington State. So I'm going to, I have here the prospectus, which legally in this country you cannot offer an application or solicit an investment. And what I'm about to say does not apply to Washington State residents. How many are Washington State people? Okay, enough of you. So I'm not talking to you yet. But to the rest of you, this is the prospectus. And right inside the front cover is the application form. Very simple. You list your amount. You choose 1, 2, or 3 years. You choose your interest rate. It can be 0%, it can be 1%, it can be 2%. And then you can state your area of preference, although I'll tell you it won't make much difference to where your money goes. And I have 7 of these. This is a sign-up sheet for Washington State residents who want information. And here's why I can't give you the prospectus. There are law firms in this country who do nothing but focus. Let me back up. There's been so much stock market fraud in the United States that regulating the sale of securities is a state-by-state phenomenon. In Pennsylvania, we can't sell the Oikocredit product for sale here because in Pennsylvania, you have to sell a Pennsylvania-only product. And so if you're in Pennsylvania, I'll connect you with the Pennsylvania-only product. There are law firms that just specialize on knowing what are the security laws of all the different states. And right now I'm involved in 2-hour conference calls once or twice a month with 2 of the lawyers from this firm, McGuire Woods, which is one of the top ones in the country on this. And the senior guy in that conference call calls Washington State's statute aberrant. You either register your security or you claim a nonprofit exemption. And Oikocredit, as it's organized in the US as a nonprofit, claims that exemption. The nonprofit is registered in the state of Illinois as a non-member corporation. Washington State's law says that before you can claim a nonprofit exemption, you must be an organization, before I can solicit Washington State residents to invest in Oikocredit, you must be a member of this non-member corporation or a contributor to this corporation that discourages donations because it wants to talk to you about investment, or a listed participant in. And when we asked them why in London, they said, well, you know, I mean, if a church was going to sell an investment product, you would sell it, you'd have your members who are already donating to you and were on your membership role, so they were a listed participant in. Oikocredit is such a strange phenomenon. Nobody tried to write the laws to write them out, but nobody imagined that a church-related organization wouldn't have members and wouldn't encourage donations and wouldn't, I mean, we said, well, how about a mailing list? Does that count as a listed participant? They said no. So we're working on the protocol. There's another meeting next week when I get back, another conference call. I think by the end of September, we'll have the protocol down, and it will probably involve something like saying, I can stand up and tell you about the wonders of microcredit and the wonders of Oikocredit, and if you ask me how it's funded, I'll say by investors, and if you ask me how you can be an investor, I'll say, donate a minimum of $25 to the loan pool, and then 14 days after the date of your check, we'll be able to send you a prospectus and invite you to join it. That's kind of where the Washington State thing stands at the moment, but it hasn't been finalized or agreed to by the state. We've been working on it since January, and we're almost there, I think. Does that address the issue you want?
What they said 2 weeks ago was, we'll probably be able to accept investments late fall, early winter.
Yeah, right, or sooner. No. Questions?
Oh, we are
at our hour. Let me just remind you that Scripture gives us an ecumenical imperative. Jesus' last prayer for his disciples were that they may all be one. The only reason we're not there is the institutional self-interests of our churches, many of which are involved. The ELCA has $1 million invested in Oiko Credit, but it never bothered to tell its members. So you're ahead of the curve. I recommend, there's some literature here for you. If you would like to know how to invest as a Washington State resident, please sign this. If you are from another state and are serious about investing, come and see me for one of these. And lastly, this beautiful bulletin insert, of which I only have one copy, is available in unlimited quantity for the asking. So if you would like to order these for a community that you're part of or your church, then sign this sign-up sheet, which has written at the top, for bulletin insert. Or call them and just say, send me some of that bulletin insert. It's very cool. We can spread this word, not just because it's an opportunity for us to directly contribute to empowering the poor in a dignified way. Remember what I said on Tuesday, as opposed to a dignity-robbing way. But we can also promote, get to know this organization, because I'm convinced it's a huge, untapped evangelical tool to impress people who think churches aren't very impressive.